Welcome to Oh God, What Now? I'm Ros Taylor. On today's show, Liz Truss joins us to talk about her new book, 10 Years to Save the West. Oh, I would say we asked her on, but that wouldn't be true either. In this edition, we'll be discussing the alarming escalation of the war in the Middle East. Chatham House Chief Bronwyn Maddox will be talking about exactly what's lacking in Britain's armed forces. She says we need to get real about the threats. And in the second half of the show, the panel answer as many of your questions as we can in a But Your Email special. Let's meet the panel. First up, it's political comedian Matt Green. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
Though we haven't got an interview with Liz Truss, the panel will be talking about her book in the second show of this week. But we do have a few tidbits thanks to the Mail serialisation, and she told another podcaster today that she wouldn't rule out running as leader again. Yes. What have we learnt about those 45 doomed days?
I mean, double fingers crossed on running again, because that would be incredible. I don't want her to win again, but I definitely want her to run again and see what happens. She is amazing. I mean, the extracts in the Mail over the last few days have been genuinely funny in a way that I've not seen for a long time. She's this incredible narrator of her own life. She's sort of a mix between Alan Partridge, Adrian Mole, and sort of Pooter as well. There's a sort of Diary of a Nobody thing going on. Half the extracts felt to me like a sort of grumpy two-star review on TripAdvisor. So there's some moaning about the fleas that Boris's dog, or possibly Boris, that wasn't clear, had left behind. Complaining about the John Lewis furniture that they had to slum it with because the furniture they ordered didn't arrive until they had been evicted, which her words for leaving because everything went wrong. She talks about being focused on delivery, but then couldn't even get Ocado delivered. She complains about having to share chevening with Dominic Raab, who left behind smoothies in the fridge, moaned that the phone signal was rubbish. And then the cleaner didn't come. And there's an amazing bit that was in the extract today about going to Checkers sort of during the whole sort of mini budget crisis, where, and I just want to quote this for a sec, the staff were very welcoming, but it was hard to relax. Checkers had at one stage been owned by Oliver Cromwell's descendants, and on the upper floor, the Cromwell corridor was replete with memorabilia. I wasn't in the best frame of mind to enjoy reminders of the English Civil War. You can sort of hear that in Partridge voice, you know. And then one other bit I just want to quote was, I'm gregarious and I like people, but even my best friends wouldn't describe me as a great people manager. It's just brilliant. Like she, you know, the Queen dies and her first response is, why me? Why now? She describes being Prime Minister as being like a prisoner. It's amazing. I'm genuinely looking forward to reading it.
Excellent. You don't have long to wait. It's out today. Al, also on the panel this week, is historian and author of Behind Closed Doors, The Secret Life of London Private Members Clubs, Seth Tevos. Hi, Seth.
Hello, Ros.
It seems that Harold Wilson, who, for our younger listeners, was twice Labour PM during the 60s and 70s, had an affair while he was in Number 10. And he wouldn't be the last. But who was this lady, and why is this a bit of a surprise?
Well, it turns out it was a deputy press secretary by the name of Janet Hewlett Davis. It's a surprise because he's widely rumoured to have had an affair with another of his staffers, Marsha Falkender. But the only reason we know about this is because Joe Haynes, his press secretary, has told us, before I die, I want everyone to know this. Every time one of these stories comes up, I do keep being reminded that Joe Haynes is still alive at 96. But the main response to this, I have to say, is who cares? Because Joe Haynes has actually slipped out some other rather interesting details in the past, like about the so-called Lavender List that Wilson signed when he retired, which was basically buying off a bunch of honours to extremely dubious characters who donated, let's say, money to charities of Harold Wilson's choice. And of course, within the lifetimes of both Harold Wilson and Marsha Falkender, there were excellent legal reasons why we couldn't talk about that, but we certainly can now.
The Times ran a piece about what it called Wilson's unconventional allure, which had a picture of him sitting in his shorts smoking a pipe, as it always does. I remember reading similar articles about John Major after his affair with Edwina Curry came out. Did Wilson have an allure?
Well, I mean, what was it about the short, pot-bellied, buck-toothed prime minister that was such a sex machine for so many people? No, genuinely, I don't know, and I don't care, to be honest with this. Haynes has suggested that Wilson did have other affairs, including a very, very brief one, with Marsha Falkender, about half an hour, apparently. But, you know, a lot of this is down to, really, does it matter that much 40 years ago that people were sleeping with each other? I mean, the thing to remember is that Westminster is and always has been an incredibly small world, and it's actually not terribly healthy just for people's mental health, frankly, to be in such a small set of rooms with such a small group of people. And weirdly enough, funny things do happen over time.
Half an hour, clearly not an entirely successful encounter. And rounding off the panel is New Statesman Associate Political Editor Rachel Cunliffe.
Hello.
Hello, Rachel. The long-awaited CAS review into how trans-identifying kids are treated came out last week. Fair to say it was critical. What did it say needs to change?
A lot of things. So this is a report that is hundreds of pages long. I haven't read all of it. I think most of the people commenting on it probably haven't read all of it. It's quite a contentious topic at a time where talking about this issue is something that can really get tempers up. And actually, that was mentioned in the report, the toxicity just surrounding the debate. But essentially, there are concerns that young people turning up to the NHS gender services were not assessed holistically, or may have been sent down a medicalized path when they had other mental health conditions that you would hope would also have been assessed. And I think at the heart of it is a wider conversation about mental health services, particularly child and adolescent mental health services, that have incredibly long waiting lists and are chronically underfunded. And there are concerns that in this particular area, young people presenting with gender dysphoria were assessed for that, as opposed to any of their other mental health needs being taken into account. But like I said, very contentious. And the response to it has, from a lot of people, been, whatever my position was before this came out, this has just strengthened my position. Whereas I think stepping back and looking at how you treat people who have a range of complex conditions would probably be better for the young people involved, rather than turning it into a sort of culture war football.
Hopefully it is the start of finding it easier to talk about generally. Before we start, a little news about Oh God, What Now? Live shows. We've got another one coming up very soon, and Patreon people have been the first to learn about it and get a ticket discount. There's a full announcement on Friday's show, but if you want to be ahead of the queue, search Patreon Oh God What Now and sign up. We will see you there. On Saturday night, Iran launched over 300 missiles at Israel, the vast majority of which were shot down by Israel's own defences and US and UK jets. It's the latest escalation in the war in the Middle East, and at the time of recording, we're still waiting to see how Israel will react. The US has urged Benjamin Netanyahu not to launch a revenge attack. Joe Biden said Israel should take the win. But it's not at all clear how much sway Biden has over his ally. Seth, Joe Biden has struggled to rein in Netanyahu since October, but he really needs to do so now, doesn't he?
Well, clearly, I mean, you're looking at Israel as a country with a nuclear weapons program and Iran as a country with a nuclear program. But it's easier said than done to look at what should actually be done. Netanyahu leads probably the most hardline government in Israel's history, and so that doesn't make negotiations particularly easy.
Is there anything he could practically do to try to stop another escalation that is also politically thinkable?
A lot of the attention is focused on the idea of arms embargoes, and certainly the US does supply a lot of weapons to Israel. But actually, this current situation plays right into Netanyahu's hands, because his argument is we do need to defend ourselves from other countries which don't wish us particularly well. There are much more formal and informal pressures that could be used. The problem Biden has is he's under the constraint of a presidential election which is ongoing. It's not that Jewish voters in the US, for example, are a particularly electorally significant group in that many swing states, but it has become an article of faith in American electoral politics that, of course, you support Israel. I mean, no US politician today would not hold that view. So I don't think Joe Biden is really in a position to go very far beyond saying, I've privately tried to assure and plead with Netanyahu to think again and to moderate his stance.
Speaking of the presidential election, Donald Trump has weighed in, inevitably. He's also in court this week for the Stormy Daniels hush money case. He claims the Iranian attack only happened because the US showed great weakness. Does public opinion in the US really want the country to get more involved?
I think Trump has very much been tapping into a long US tradition of isolationism and the question of why should we, you know, put our soldiers on the line. And that's really strong right now amongst Republican rhetoric over Ukraine. So I think even the Republicans would start to notice it would seem a little bit odd to take a more aggressive stance elsewhere. So absolutely, the view on a lot of this permeating it is what's in it for us.
Yes, this is what I don't understand. At the same time, the US has shown great weakness, but the instinct is towards isolationism. Yeah. Perhaps I shouldn't expect anything more profound. Matt, were you surprised to learn that RAF fighters had been involved in shooting down the missiles on Saturday night?
I mean, I'm not kept personally abreast of UK military strategy. So, yes, it was a surprise. I wasn't surprised, I think, that the UK was involved to some extent in that, you know, we obviously have bases in the area. And I think whatever issues the government has had with Israel over the last few weeks, particularly with Gaza, obviously, I think they're always going to take Israel's side over Iran. And I think the fact that the US got involved, the UK always wants to be sort of on the right hand side of the US with that. So, I mean, I think it was a surprise that it was such a big attack and it involved so many different people sort of countering it.
Rishi Sunak gave a statement about the action today in the Commons. What did we learn from that?
As we record that, he's kind of pretty much just sat down. I don't think he said very much that we wouldn't have expected. He said it was a reckless and dangerous escalation. He said the British planes were involved. They destroyed drones and missiles. But I think he's clear that the UK is working to encourage de-escalation. He said there were three vital steps to put the Middle East on a better path, as he put it. Number one was security for Israel. Number two was investing more in the two-state solution. And he mentioned that the UK has been working with the Palestinian Authority on how to provide sort of governance after the war in Gaza ends. And number three is the war in Gaza has to end. He said that he's going to be phoning Netanyahu later today and will be urging restraint on him, which is that phrase that gets used so often here in the news, you know. And he also reminded everyone that Iranian drones were also used by Russia and have been used by Russia a lot against Ukraine. And I think that's quite important. There was quite a lot of comment on that. Ben Wallace asked about that, and he said basically Israel didn't want to help Ukraine when Ukraine was attacked. Maybe now they could help Ukraine. Suella Braverman asked him about proscribing the Revolutionary Guard. And George Galloway stood up. And I'd not seen him in the Commons until now. That was interesting. And he said that, as you might expect, he attacked the Prime Minister for not mentioning the attack on the consulate in Damascus, which obviously a lot of people would say is the beginning of this round of action. And he said that Iran wouldn't listen to the UK because of the coup in 1953 and all of the, you know, the fact that the Britain was involved in that. And then he sat down and didn't ask a question. And I think everyone was like, oh, is that it? Okay, fine.
Do you think he only did it so that his speech could be clipped up for social media
100%.
And Twitter and, you know, maybe that...
It wouldn't surprise me if it's exactly 2 minutes to 20 seconds long, which is a Twitter, which is how long you can be on Twitter.
The undercurrent of all these calls for restraint is really saying, Israel, for God's sake, rein it in, or this is going to get completely out of control.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's what Cameron's been banging the drum on in interviews all day, saying, you know, essentially that phrase that I think you've mentioned, Joe Biden said, you know, take the win, be smart as well as tough. We've got to think, Israel has to think with its head as well as its heart. All these phrases basically essentially trying to say, look, you did the thing in Damascus. We're not necessarily condemning that outright, but we are, and we're not saying that those two things are comparable directly. And it's that sort of diplomatic way of trying to say, let's draw a line under it, whilst unfortunately, as Seth pointed out, Israel has such a right-wing government, or particularly parts of it are so right-wing now that they are, you know, Ben Gavir said we should go further and I can't remember the phrase he used now exactly, you know, we need to smash them, we need to crush them, all this kind of stuff. So I think basically, yeah, all the G7 countries are united in saying, take a step back.
And there's a lot of flattery of Netanyahu, isn't there, essentially, which must, yeah, I can see why they're doing it, but at the same time, it's infuriating for people who are angry about what is happening in Gaza.
I always think this with these sorts of situations, that it's difficult to show that you have leverage if you're also saying that we will support you no matter what. But that is diplomacy. There are often these situations where people who are our allies are also people we want to influence. And how do you make those two things work together? And I think if you've got Biden coming out and saying, you know, our defense of Israel will be ironclad, it's then hard to see how he can realistically use leverage against Israel. I feel like one of those things where I think there must be other things going on behind closed doors, but that's in public, it feels like it's kind of a bit of a paradox.
Yeah. Rachel, did Keir Starmer hit the right tone in the comments today, do you think? He pressed Sunak a bit on ensuring aid gets to Gaza.
He did. And he also mentioned obliquely the attack on the consulate. He said, if diplomacy takes centre stage, and it must, then we also need to be clear that diplomatic premises should not be targeted and attacked. That is a point of principle. So that is a coded, although not particularly subtly coded, rebuke of Israel, with kind of what Matt was saying, sort of, we're not going to comment on that, but we're aware that it happened, and just be a bit careful. I think from what I've seen, Starmer's position is actually somewhere between Rishi Sunak's position and David Cameron's position, because they're not united on this. And there are some quite interesting splits in the Conservative Party. We've talked a lot since October 7th about the splits in the Labour Party over this, but the Conservative Party is not united in it either. And Cameron, who as Foreign Secretary sometimes steals the limelight a bit or overshadows Rishi Sunak. He's definitely a better communicator.
Yeah,
I wrote this column last week on exactly that, on about how his communication style is just really a cut above Sunak's. However, Sunak is the Prime Minister.
Yes, I've got to remember that.
At the time of recording, anyway. So there are these divisions, and you can see the difference in language, and that helps Starmer because he can be in between the two of them, and he can push Sunak on humanitarian aid and on exerting pressure on Netanyahu to be proportional and to take a step back while still being in the same space as the Conservatives, because you've got Cameron going off and being a bit stronger. So I think that has not made it easier for him, because like this isn't easy for anyone, but that has made a little bit wider the space in which Starmer is able to occupy.
So just to be clear for listeners who haven't been following it in detail, what would you say the differences are between Cameron and Sunak? You say Cameron's been a bit stronger in which direction?
Stronger in condemning Israel and Netanyahu, and stronger in suggesting that Israel needs to show restraint, and particularly on the topic of humanitarian aid, while still saying, of course, Israel has the right to defend itself, but he's sort of been out there saying, and we need to speak to our allies, Netanyahu, and exert our influence in that way.
But of course, there are many Labour politicians who would like to see Starmer putting Sunak under more pressure than Cameron is. How much pressure is he under to call for the UK to stop selling arms to Israel? We don't sell a lot to them, so it wouldn't be very meaningful. But nonetheless, it would be a powerful sign, if you like, if we were to stop doing that.
So I think, as Seth has already mentioned, the issue of selling arms to Israel is less pertinent perhaps this week than it was last week. That doesn't mean people aren't upset about it. It doesn't mean it's not going to flare up again. And if you were advising Netanyahu on how he is viewed by politicians across the West, you might want to point out that sympathy and patience is really wearing thin. And this latest development sort of works in his favour to some extent, but it's not permanent.
Do you think behind the scenes he's talking to these unhappy Labour backbenchers about the situation? Because there doesn't feel like there's much he could do now to placate them that would be very meaningful. But do you think there are conversations behind the scenes?
I think there are certainly conversations behind the scenes within the cabinet, because the Labour shadow cabinet is also sort of split on this. There are some Labour MPs who are backbenchers who are furious with Keir Starmer, and I don't think Keir Starmer, to be honest, worries that much about them. And for all that Labour is at risk of losing votes in some of its ordinarily very safe areas, the benefit of having this position is that you appeal to more people outside of those areas, and it actually makes Labour's vote more efficient, electorally efficient anyway, if you can appeal to people outside sort of standard areas. There is this organisation called TMV, the Muslim Vote, that has specifically said it will run candidates or support independent candidates against Labour in Labour safe seats, and that is something that Labour are watching. But in general, people on the far left of the Labour Party being upset with Keir Starmer are not going to cost them an election. Keir Starmer being seen as not standing up for British interests and security.
Starmer said last week that he wants to raise defence spending to 2.5% of GDP as soon as resources allow. And in a move guaranteed to annoy the left of the party, he's recommitted to the nuclear deterrent. I spoke to the chief of Chatham House and host of the Independent Thinking podcast, Bronwyn Maddox, about whether 2.5% is enough and what the most serious threats facing the UK are. Bronwyn, Starmer's promised to spend 2.5% on defence when we can afford it. Is 2.5% enough?
Well, it's a start. We're at 2.1% now. The Conservative government has also said it will spend 2.5% of GDP, or it will aim to, but it hasn't put a date on that. All that that indicates, it really then, is a recognition from the Conservative government that it sees the importance of spending on defence. Same for Keir Starmer. It's not exactly a commitment. Again, it's an assertion of the importance of this. Now, the importance is beyond dispute. We have conflicts and potential threats to the UK breaking out on all sides. You have the huge problem of Ukraine, in the sense that Russia thinks it has the upper hand and is looking to make a big breakthrough this year. And obviously the support of money and ammunition that Ukraine was expecting to get from the US has not come through yet and may not. And so it falls on countries like Britain and others in Europe and others like Japan or South Korea to do what they can. Then you have obviously the Middle East in some turmoil. You have a nasty conflict in Sudan, which could easily spread threats to the Red Sea and potential threats of terrorism in all kinds of places. So there is no doubt we're in dangerous times. But all that we're hearing from either Labour or the Conservatives is we recognise this. We want to spend more money on it. But the fact is Britain doesn't have the money for all the things any government might reasonably want to spend it on. And defence is a public service, like health and education and many others, and is going to have to argue for its share.
We keep hearing that there are serious defects and shortages and difficulty recruiting personnel, things like that, in the armed forces. Where are the particular pinch points? Where are the problems greatest at the moment?
They're all over the place. It's on big bits of kit and improvements. You keep hearing about the improvements needed, whether it is to the Trident nuclear deterrent or to aircraft carriers or to tanks and aircraft or to missiles and replenishment of missiles or to the sheer number of people in the armed forces, particularly the army, where there's been a big problem of recruitment. So it's right across the board. Famously, and this goes back a long, long way, defence has not been great at procurement, and it's driven the Public Accounts Committee in Parliament to distraction to give the ministry just a bit of a break on this. It is really quite hard to buy big kit many years in advance of the reason that it might be needed and make sure it's all in working order. But Britain has been bad at over-engineering things, over-specifying them, bespoking them, and just not keeping it all working.
Given that Britain would probably be operating as part of an alliance, I hear arguments from a couple of think tanks that we have historical strength in naval defence for obvious reasons. And so we should very much lean into that and let, say, the French do air and perhaps other countries concentrate on the army. Is there something to be said for that argument?
It really depends what the conflict is. I don't think we can generalise on that. And the UK, has been strong in the Navy, but not all parts of that. And the aircraft carriers, which are part of the Navy, but obviously supporting the Air Force, have been troubled, not just in their routine training and action, but in the questions of how they're going to be deployed. I think Britain can most usefully say to its allies that it can help across the board. Also with intelligence, also with special forces. And those are two areas where the UK has contributed a lot to quite a lot of conflicts. But you really need to see where those conflicts are, and they're not all the same.
If we imagine, say, in 2026, Trump was now president of the United States and had essentially indicated he would not participate in NATO in a meaningful way in Europe. And Putin, Russia, decided to invade Estonia or Latvia or perhaps Lithuania. And Britain acted as part of a force of a number of European countries. What role can you see us, can you imagine us playing in that? What kind of things would be needed? What sort of defense kit? Have we thought about what this? Well, I'm sure other people have, but have we thought about what this would involve and how ready we are for a scenario like that?
We're not particularly ready, but we're readier than some countries, partly because of having taken a very clear stance on Ukraine. And that's something that has been consistent through the whole batch of Conservative prime ministers that we've had recently, the Johnson, Truss, Sunak sequence, and in Labour as well with Keir Starmer, saying, look, we are completely behind Ukraine and we're behind not just the offence to those people, we're behind the principle of defending a democratic country against being invaded. So I think Britain starts from the advantage of clarity, and that is something in itself. The UK has been very helpful, I think, even though we've left the EU, at giving leadership to EU countries. France, President Macron has been both in the beginning very, very conciliatory almost to President Putin, and now very much the reverse. Germany very, very much divided on the stance it wants to take. Then it really depends what the threat is. And you're asking very particular things about the nature of an armed response. Missiles always matter. Drones matter increasingly. Whether ships matter depends. I mean, Estonia and others are on the Baltic. That could matter. But increasingly, we're also looking at cyber defense, at protection of cables under the sea, if we're really talking about a conflict that could expand. These are things that the UK has thought about. What forms modern warfare, particularly fairly close to home, might take. What it isn't good at is the sheer scale of military, if you like, because there's no getting round it. The UK's military is smaller than in the past.
Will we need to rethink our nuclear deterrent if we don't have the security of the US behind us?
That is a very good question. It's very expensive, but it does do various things. Support an alliance of other nuclear weapon states, give Britain access to that famous top table of defence discussions, to the UN Security Council and so on. I don't think we're in a time when rethinking it is going to have whole head of steam behind it. If by rethinking, you mean scrapping it. Because we are in a time when nuclear proliferation looks worryingly like a rising threat. So we're on the edge of a time when people are going to be talking more about this, not just about terrorism, which we're not talking much about at the moment, but we could easily be, and yet about those old classic things of whether arms control can be made to work. And I don't think that it is an environment in which giving up a nuclear deterrent is going to have a whole lot of support behind it.
You've given us a powerful sense of all the threats out there. But it has to be said that in the UK at the moment, most people's concerns are domestic and are worried about the state of the country and the way that many parts of the welfare state in particular are falling apart. Do you think that given the state we're in at the moment, people are thinking seriously enough about the external threats? What will it take for people to understand how serious these threats are?
Well, it would take even more conflicts breaking out. It would take a resumption of terrorism close to home. And we've been, thankfully, largely spared that. But that wouldn't take very much to rise up again. These weapons that have been used in modern wars, including drones, are ones that are also very easily used by what is called in the jargon non-state actors. But I think people are, they may not focus on the details of foreign policy and threats. And as you said, it's just people deeply, deeply worried about the cost of living, about the sort of uncertainty of what they can expect at home. But I think people do feel they're living in a very uncertain world and want governments to give some reassurance to that, to give some reassurance that they're doing what they can about the defense of the country, which may seem abstract in peaceful times, but is one of the prime functions of the state is to defend its people.
Bronwyn, thanks so much for talking to us.
My great pleasure.
Rachel, as Bronwyn said, the nuclear deterrent is expensive, very expensive. What does Starmer's committing to it tell us about what kind of PM he would be when it comes to defence?
I think what it tells us is he would really like to be PM. And I don't want to put this purely in terms of the polls, but the nuclear deterrent is another one of those issues that really agitates people within the Labour Party. But the country as a whole is quite pro-Trident. YouGov runs a tracker of how people feel about what should happen to Trident at the end of its natural life, as it were. And 42% of people think it should be replaced with exactly the same, like for like. 19% think it should be replaced with something a bit cheaper but similar. And only 15% of people think that it should be scrapped entirely. And when you run other questions about how we feel about having a nuclear deterrent, it's generally something that the majority of the public think that we ought to have. I think this is another case of Starmer looking outside of the Labour Party and also being quite keen to play into defence in the same way that he's played into law and order and crime. There was that trip that he did in December. He went to a UK army base in Estonia. He wore the army fatigues. That picture was everywhere. He got mocked for wearing the army fatigues. That is something that Jeremy Corbyn would never have done. He would never have gone to that base, and he would absolutely never have worn army fatigues. So I think it's about signalling that this iteration of the Labour Party is not afraid of topics like defence and patriotism and British values and all of those things that, you know, the Daily Mail gets very excited about. It is a bid to appeal to that. But I think it is also probably broadly where the majority of the country is as well.
Matt, it's a difficult line to draw in a way because at the same time, Starmer doesn't want to be mistaken for Tony Blair. I don't get the sense that he's going to be an enthusiastic interventionist along the lines of Blair. But what do you think his instincts will on defence will be? Would he have sent in those RAF jets at the weekend, for example?
I think so. Well, certainly based on what he said in the Commons, he was very supportive and said that the RAF did a great job and we should be proud of them and that people had put themselves in danger and all those things. I do think, as Rachel said, like lots of Labour leaders, with the obvious exception of Corbyn, feel like they have to look tough in this situation because it's something that it's an area that traditionally the public might be a little bit worried about with Labour, that they're going to be soft on defence. And I think, obviously, coming after Corbyn, it's undeniable that a lot of what Starmer has done is essentially be the reverse of Corbyn. And this is a clear example where he can be. I mean, I don't know about the interventionist thing. I think we don't really know with Starmer. I haven't heard him say very much about foreign affairs, apart from the sort of general things that are in the news. Sadly, I think we're going into a time where foreign affairs will be more and more of a thing day to day. I think it's going to be an issue that he's not going to have Blair's sort of honeymoon period of the first 2 or 3 years where he didn't have to kind of get involved in things. I think things are going to happen quite a lot. So, yeah, watch this space, I think.
I think he's going to be very led by other world leaders, particularly in America, although not if it's Trump, because if Trump gets in again, then all bets on foreign policy are off. But I think it is notable that British military forces went in to support US forces with this and actually were specifically asked to do so. Like, I guess they requested it knowing that we probably wouldn't say no. But I can imagine Starmer taking a very collegiate approach to foreign policy, not just with America, but look at what France is doing, what Germany's doing, and trying to reach a decision by consensus.
I mean, I think the Trump comparison is interesting, though, because I think Blair, obviously with Clinton, had a good relationship there. But when Bush came in, he felt like he also had to have a good relationship there. And arguably that's where so many of the problems that he ended up in with Iraq and Afghanistan and things like that, that's where that started. So I think if Starmer is faced with the Trump presidency, that's going to be quite a big, well, a huge challenge to what will he do if Trump either decides to be totally isolationist or decides to go in somewhere and do something very aggressive militarily, what would Starmer do? And I've got no idea. It feels like obviously his electorate would want him to do the exact opposite of what Trump did, but then it's kind of what Blair found himself in.
Next up, it's been a while since we dedicated a whole section to questions from our fantastic Patreon backers, and our inbox has been filling up lately, so we thought we'd have a go at answering as many as we can in a But Your Email special. First up, it's Mark Jameson. Hello, Mark. He says, do outrageous lies help or hinder the Tories? He mentions the idea that London is the new Gotham City, which was perhaps implied rather than actually said in that recent Tory online ad. He also cites the £350 million for the NHS Brexit bus scandal. What do you think, Seth?
Let's talk about dead cats, because Linton Crosby used to describe this as the dead cat strategy. It moves the Overton window of conversation. And if you chuck a dead cat on the table, never mind the fact that you're not talking about any of the important issues, everyone is talking about you and everybody is talking about the presence of the dead cat and the denial of the dead cat and the explanation for the dead cat. And actually, it is helping them to win. There is something fundamentally Trumpian about that, and that is why it is so dangerous to a healthy, functioning democracy.
So they help the Tories, and that's Absolutely. Why they do them.
Well, I was going to say, I slightly disagree with that. I think it depends on how easy they are to disprove. I think the £350 million for the NHS was so sort of brilliantly awful as a campaign slogan because it was, nobody quite knew what the real figure was. It wasn't something that anybody sort of outside of politics really knew about. It was a big amount of money. So people thought, oh gosh, are we giving that much to the EU? And whatever the actual figure was, it made people think about that. Whereas London is Gotham City hellhole isn't true. so like, and particularly if you're trying to get people in London to vote for you, obviously, well, we live in London most, you know, and it's fine. I mean, obviously it's not perfect, but it's certainly not what they were portraying in that advert. So I think, yeah, it for me, it depends on how good the dead cat is in terms of whether people can immediately go, well, that's rubbish though. And I think they used to be better at it. I think they've got worse at it.
So Dominic Cummings has said, what Seth said essentially, is that you say 350 million to the NHS and people go, it's not 350 million, it's only 175, whatever it is. And what people hear is a lot of money is yeah. going to the EU. It could be spent on the NHS instead. And that helps. The London one, you know, I agree entirely. But Susan Hill is doing a similar thing. She's the Tory candidate for London Mayor running against Sadiq Khan. She's doing a similar thing when it comes to pay per mile yeah. road pricing, where she's got all these. I interviewed her a couple of months ago and she said, and that's what Sadiq Khan wants to bring in. And I was like, he doesn't know. And she's like, oh, well, he will. And so there was this picture of like the ULEZ sign and then underneath a kind of you're entering a pay per mile zone that was photoshopped or AI generated or not real. And she was like, the picture may not be real, but the message is. Like, that's not how it works. So I think if they are really, really evidently disprovable, they harm your credibility. But if you can start a conversation going about something that people might not have known about, then they at least get the conversation there. And it is kind of Trumpian.
But is that the future of political advertising, a sort of virtual reality AI photoshopped
yeah.
world?
Well, she's essentially doing the same thing that people were doing in the in the aftermath of the stabbings, that saying, well, this is, it could have been
it
one of these. It, you know, it might have been one of those. It might have been Islamic. It might, you know, and in the way that you go, well, but it wasn't that. So, and he might be doing that, but he isn't doing that. So why don't you talk about the things he is doing? Is always my thought.
I like the idea of a sort of AI generated political ads. And then pretty soon we can have AI voters and then none of us have to do anything.
Yeah. Just press a button and everything happens.
Everything happens, yeah.
So the answer to your question, Mark, is that outrageous lies have helped the Tories in the past, but I suspect that in a sort of Pinocchio-like way, the more lies that they tell, the more obvious it becomes that they are lying. Mm. And so the payoff is decreasing as time goes on. In other words, it's not working for them anymore. So that is a hopeful answer, I hope. Claire Nurk asks, lots of talk the other week about abolishing the monarchy, which sadly I missed, but I'm interested to hear what the panel would put in its place, presidential style, a la France or US, or a silent president a la Germany. Or is the current setup the best of a bad bunch of options? She says silly options are also welcome.
My cat.
Yeah, I was going to say, I genuinely was going to say an animal.
But specifically my cat, because she
Obviously.
Would be brilliant at it. Yeah.
Would she have a sort of 10-year term and then, or 5 years?
I think she'd just do it for until she goes to the big kitty playground in the sky.
Or the vets, as we yes, think of it.
The look in Rachel's eye now is genuinely slightly scary. Actually, this is a good idea.
It would have to be a dog, though, in Britain, because Britons love dogs. It could only be a dog. It couldn't be a cat. I'm sorry.
A bulldog wearing a top hat.
But I think there's this idea that you can, I don't know, I don't have a dog, but you can train dogs. And surely you want a monarch who is just, you know, entirely untrainable on a different level above everything. Just, you never know what they're going to do next. You know that whatever they do next is going to be like the only thing you can focus on. I'm really enjoying having my cat in my new house, if no one has noticed that. Can I just say that I like the monarchy, and maybe it's a very unpopular thing to say on this podcast, and I wouldn't design it this way. I don't think it, like, there's this mad idea that you've got a family dating back hundreds of years and they're all cousins, and for some reason some of them, including some MPs, still think that they are put there by God and the divine right of kings or queens or whatever. But we don't have to think about it. It's like a bit of British politics that we just do not have to think about. We know who's the monarch. We know who the next monarch is going to be. But crucially, if we get a mad, murderous dictator prime minister who tries to change all the laws and send the army in to fire on the British people, the army don't answer to the prime minister. They answer to the king. And I quite like that.
I take a slightly different view, which is that I think it's worth working out which bits of the monarchy we like and dislike. I mean, oddly enough, I take the opposite view, which is that I personally dislike a lot of our royal family. I don't think they're particularly fit for purpose. However, the thing which I think is far more important to me than the symbolism or whatever the ethos behind it is the actual power that still resides with the monarchy. I'm far more interested in removing that remaining power than I am with worrying about who does a state banquet and whether they're, you know, resigned to a life of servitude. Well, it depends on what they are individually. So one of them is the power to choose governments, which is usually automatic in most election cases. But if you have a hung parliament, it is actually the monarchy that makes the big calls. Like in 2010, setting us on the road for the next 14 years in that hung parliament, it was very much the monarchy's case. There's also the matter of the royal prerogative, which is not something that's exercised by the royal family, but it's exercised in their name, and it allows our government to bypass a lot of the normal things that other governments do. Like, for example, whenever you need to ratify a treaty in other countries that goes to their legislature, we bypass our legislature because we just say, well, in the name of the crown, it's been done. So yeah, there's a perfectly healthy question as to, you know, which is the appropriate body to do that. But I'm much more interested in those slightly geeky questions of who should be exercising those powers than I am in, you know, the flammery and ceremonial side of it.
There are also powers to meddle in laws, aren't there? There was something this week about the king getting involved in a Welsh law that would basically stop him being prosecuted. But no, we are also after more silly options. Matt, have you got any silly options for
I mean, I've got loads of silly options. How about a guy who just gets appointed, depending on who? Anyway,
but sortition.
I reckon. No, I genuinely think jury service. I think everyone gets to do it
A
bit.
I feel that way about the House of Lords.
Yeah.
We should all get a go at the House of Lords.
We've all seen King Ralph.
Combine the two, like turn into a sort of TV talent show. You know, it's a royal knockout, but genuinely, whoever wins becomes king for a year, like in The X Factor, no one cares who it is the following year, but it's sort of... I think.
Have you basically invented elections?
Yes. Well, no, it's not. Well, but the thing is, then people genuinely care about it in a way that
wouldn't it be more like traitors? I mean, yeah.
Something. I think giving
Claudia Winkleman would make a really good monarch.
Yes, she would be good.
Yeah. I do think on the whole cats versus dogs debate, the cats clearly have the advantage because they have such effortless aristocracy. Just sneeringly contemptuous of all the peasants that they're using beneath them that they would be the perfect royal family.
They've been worshipped as gods for years. I mean, as centuries. So, yeah, it makes sense.
Well, Claire, I think we can agree that no one here is very keen on the idea of a president. I'm not sure why, but I have an idea, but it's not something that we're going for, and I suspect the British public agree. Let's move on to the next question, which is not unrelated. Jessica Poynton asks, one of the good things about a constitutional monarchy is that the head of state is not a political post, not subject to elections, to opinion polls or campaigns. It being an inherited post is not ideal. Clearly. So what would the panel suggest as a way of having a political head of government and an apolitical head of state? Yes, this is a sort of extension of the previous question, isn't it?
I think Matt's already done it with sortition.
But I sort of genuinely think something like that could sort of work. Like, taking my comedian hat off for a second, I think having a sort of slightly random process where somebody gets picked slightly randomly that it exposes it as what it is, which is a ceremonial role. And as long as that person isn't completely mad, and there's got to be some sort of way in which that is dealt with, but there's no way of knowing that, you know, monarchs aren't going to end up being mad, as many have in the past been. I think a sort of random selection sort of works in that way, and give them lots of, you know, things to open and stuff to do. I'm sure it would be quite fun.
How long, and I'm not endorsing this, but how long before someone suggests an AI head of state?
An algorithm. King algorithm.
Yeah, take the personalities out of it.
I feel like that's a Netflix film next year, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right, next one. Eamon Merchant's question. Alex Andreu has suggested previously that the Conservatives might one day be the party that take us back into Europe, and I agree with him. If when the Tories perform such a volte-face, they will no doubt do so with the support of the right-wing press, and it is the same press hegemony that seems to be preventing Labour from any public pro-European policy announcements. The Sun likes to back the winner, and might well back Starmer, but is there any way that Labour can ever be free enough to proclaim whatever policies they believe in without worrying about the consequences in the Mail and Telegraph? Right, this is an interesting one. Will the Mail and Telegraph ever lose their grip on this country despite very few people actually buying physical papers anymore?
They've gone in very different directions. I mean, the thing about the Mail is it does have a vast audience as the most read news website on the planet, whether we like it or not. A lot of their readership is in the US rather than the UK, but they have made that jump. The Telegraph has gone for a much more, shall we say, sectarian model in terms of being very much not only behind the paywall, but as their membership, as their, they're not a club, maybe they are a club, as their readership gets smaller and smaller, so it becomes more a caricature of the rank and file of the Conservative Party.
Yeah, I don't think that Labour are worried about how their policies will be interpreted by the Telegraph. Or if they are worried about that, that is quite far down the list. I think they're much more worried about the Mail. We were discussing this with Hugo Rivkind on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he made the point that if the Mail came out suddenly and endorsed Starmer, it's not that Mail readers would suddenly support Starmer and Labour, it's that the readership of the Mail would go down. And I think possibly we overstate how much the papers are leading their readers into certain positions and how much they are reflecting their readers' own views back at them. So maybe it's not about convincing the Mail that Labour is right, it's about convincing voters. And then the Mail, as the Sun is starting to do, will change course slightly because they want to keep their readers.
And the Mail had a very pro-Starmer front page on Saturday about defence. It was very pleased by what he said, didn't it? So yeah, I think you're onto something there. Matt?
Yeah, I think I agree. I don't think that it's the press preventing Starmer talking about Europe. I think it's him seeing it as an issue that is not good for them at the moment. It's toxic. It's got all the issues of sort of the betrayal narrative and everything. It was only the last election, which was all about get Brexit done. I think it feels too soon. But I think, yeah, I agree that, I mean, how to avoid the papers having a big influence. I think Rachel's right. It's about convincing people. It's about making the argument. I think that's so important. I think that's a concept that gets lost a lot of the time in politics. Like, you have to persuade people. You have to make an argument and say, this is what I think and this is why. I think so often it seems to be about like, what do other people think, therefore what do I think about that, rather than, no, this is what I think, this is why. But also defend public service broadcasting. You know, don't have a situation where, you know, you've got more and more right-wing entrants into the sort of Ofcom related space who don't seem to do anything. Don't end up in a situation where we have in the US where you've got, you know, Fox News on one side and various others on the other side. I think defend the BBC, keep some sense of impartiality in the media in this country, and then it won't matter so much.
There is something about media ownership that looms large on this, because sadly there has never been a golden age where, you know, disinterested people have presided over a pluralistic range of these wonderfully outspoken investigative journalistic outlets. Instead, there are a small number of public broadcasting outlets which love them or loathe them, by and large, generally have high levels of trust. And no one almost in the history of newspapers in this country has ever not lost vast sums of money.
Yeah.
You can guarantee you'll lose money running a paper. And so you then have to ask yourself, why on earth would you ever want to buy a paper? Well, a lot of people seem to quite like the influence that comes with it.
Final question. It's from Ed Sylvester. He says, I really enjoy the quality of discussion and reasoning by the presenters of Ogwen. Thank you, Ed. I assume that the smug feelings that I encounter in having my biases confirmed are felt equally by the people I disagree with in their Writer Centre podcasts and YouTube channels, but I wouldn't know as I have not found a right-wing podcast that I can bear to listen to. Is there a podcast that the panel can recommend that gives a well-reasoned and sensible view of the other side of the argument? Please don't make me endure GB News, because that is clearly just bollocks. Right, right-wing podcasts. Can anyone recommend?
I found this really hard because I actually do quite like GB News sometimes. And I'm going to stand up for this.
What do you like about GB News? Genuine question.
I find it very entertaining. Right. And also, I find that it distills arguments that I fundamentally disagree with in very passionate terms. And it makes me think, okay, why is that bollocks? Is it bollocks because they've made it up? Is it bollocks because it's taken wildly out of context? Is it bollocks because it's going after a personal attack rather than actually engaging with it, you know, on the basis of what's actually happened? And I don't watch huge amounts of it, but I watch clips of it and I sort of look at it in an analytical way and go, okay, what are they doing there? It's not a podcast and it's specifically not what he asked for. So, sorry.
But it is useful to know what your opponents and what people you normally disagree with are thinking, because you can't really take on their arguments if you don't know
exactly
what the arguments are.
And they're also, a lot of them, and I'm not going to name presenters specifically, but they are quite good at arguing on TV. And I am someone who hates arguing on TV and I love doing podcasts like this where we have a lovely chat about everything, but I don't like the sort of confrontational debating style, and the people who go on GB News are very, very good at it, and it's interesting. You get something valuable out of watching that and going, how are they doing that?
Seth?
I've been hooked for some years, as some of your listeners may already know, on America's Mayor Live, the fastest hour on the internet with Rudy Giuliani, five nights a week. It used to be a cliche that people would say, I only read Playboy magazine for the articles. Well, I only watch Giuliani's podcast for the adverts, actually, which are fascinating. And you can hear him sort of hawking vitamin pills and pillows. Supplements, absolutely. Yeah, they're sort of freeze-dried. Oh, he's got a whole spiel going on. And there are several. I mean, I do find it fascinating because it is an insight into really, really quite marginal conspiracy theories. I mean, insane stuff, and the very ugly side of conspiracy theories as well. This is an increasingly marginalized, doddery guy who's sounding sort of quite irrelevant, and he'll sometimes be protesting that he doesn't have a drink problem whilst he's got a glass of whiskey in hand. I mean, it really is satirical. And I'm particularly intrigued by the entourage that Rudy has that does this. There aren't many people who are still talking to Rudy, but he has a guy called Ted off camera. Ted is a spokesperson for the Republican Party in Michigan and is basically Rudy's gimp and does odd jobs.
Is he definitely real? Do you know he's real?
He is, because sometimes Rudy won't show up and it's very clear that he's sort of, you know, possibly had a few drinks, and Ted will turn up looking very nervous and do the whole hour and say, you know, we never know, the mayor might turn up, he might be feeling up to it soon enough. Wow. So for all the wrong reasons, I think that Rudy Giuliani's show is a must listen. But you might need a stiff drink or two.
Well, there you go, Ed. Rudy Giuliani's show and GB News. That's where to start.
I would suggest a genuine recommendation is Jeff Norcott's podcast, What Most People Think. And it's comedy as well as politics. And Jeff is a comedian and he's definitely more on the sort of centre-right of things. Obviously, a while ago, he kind of made a splash as being, you know, a Tory voting comedian, which was quite rare at the time. But I do think he is genuinely thoughtful, fair-minded. I rarely hear him express opinions that are not thought through, are sort of extreme for the sake of being extreme, or are just reactive or reactionary. I don't agree with a fair amount of what he says, certainly about politics. And he sometimes interviews people who, again, I'm not a huge fan of in terms of their opinions, but I don't ever see him... Yeah, I never feel that he's doing something just to get a rise out of you in the way that there are lots of comedians who've sort of popped up recently sort of going, I'm very right-wing, and then they're just being very provocative for the sake of it. So I did his podcast a few months ago, and I found it very interesting. And he was sort of challenging me a bit on certain things. And I had, yeah, as Rachel said, it's good to sort of make yourself think about, okay, why do I think that? What do I think about that? And he said to me, I feel, you know, a lot of my listeners, his listeners, think that the Tory party are very left-wing at the moment. And I had to really think about that and go, "What? Why is that?" And I, you know, we had that discussion. So yeah, I would genuinely recommend that. I think that's good.
Brilliant. Thanks for those. We've reached the end of the show, so it's time for escape routes. What books, films, music, and miscellaneous other things have the panel been using as their shelter from reality this week? Seth?
I've been reading Tim Shipman's new book, No Way Out, which I think comes out in a week or two. I'm reviewing it at the moment.
How is that a distraction? How is that an escape route?
Well,
that's the day job.
Unlike the last two books, which are super, super topical, this one has, you know, taken 6 years to come out for a variety of reasons. And I would say that it's compelling, but at the same time, it very much is the world according to Dominic Cummings. You know, Shipman doesn't disclose, naturally, his sources, but his source isn't Dominic Cummings, then I'm your Aunt Sally.
What's it about? What's the general sort of overall?
It's basically a blow-by-blow account of 2018 to 19 until the resignation of Theresa May.
Right.
Agonising. Matt?
I've been watching the IPL a lot, the Indian Premier League, the cricket, which has been great. But also yesterday, I watched Tetris, the movie, which surprisingly, I've really enjoyed. It was surprisingly tense, very entertaining. It's a film about true-ish story about how a guy managed to get the rights for the game Tetris out of the USSR as the USSR was collapsing. And it features a pretty much unrecognisable Roger Allam as Robert Maxwell, who has a very interesting part to play in that story. I had no idea.
Rachel?
I'm late on this, and I'm also going to recommend another podcast, which I know is... I finally listened to Who Trolled Amber, the Tortoise Media investigative podcast about Amber Heard and Johnny Depp and the campaign of online hate against her. And it turns out it's not really about Amber Heard at all. It's about geopolitics and just the weird world of the internet, and it is utterly gripping, and it is the kind of podcast, usually when I listen to podcasts like I'm doing something else at the same time, it's one that I just want to sit down in the quiet room and just listen to.
Great, those are the really good ones when you don't have to do something else at the same time. Well, I've been thinking about cricket because I was lying in bed on Saturday morning trying to fight off fourth migraine of the week and thinking how much I would like to be listening to Test Match Special and how sad it was that I wasn't. And then I realised that there wasn't really anybody else I knew at the moment who liked cricket, because all the people I knew who liked cricket have died. And so I, for some reason, I tweeted about this. I wouldn't normally do that kind of thing, but, you know, there are times. And there are a remarkable number of people who said, "I like cricket," including Matt here.
Yes, I did.
So that was delightful, because we had a conversation earlier all about cricket. And now I feel that there are people out there who enjoy it, and I'm not alone and just slipping rapidly into late middle age. So that was exciting. And that's the end of the Tuesday edition of Oh God, What Now? Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
Rachel.
Thank you.
And Seth.
Thank you.
Oh God, What Now? We'll be back on Thursday for our backers and Friday morning for everyone else. And now we've just got time to name check some of our new Patreon supporters. Since we mentioned the tightening ad market, we've been inundated with new and returning backers. You too can join them. Just follow the link in the show notes or search Patreon Oh God, What Now? And now here's a salute to some of our new recruits.
Hello, thank you for joining our supporters just in time for the end of the world to Stephen Carter, Leon, Northern Bastard, and Matt French, who probably hates Northern Bastard. Who knows?
Thanks for your generous support, and welcome aboard from me to Robert Reed, Mark Dando, Chris Seddon, and Rob Smith.
Hello from me, and welcome to this exclusive club to Alex Wilson, Matt Barron, Stefan, and George Graver.
And a special thank you to these returning patrons who have come back to supporting the pod after a little time away. Samuel Little, Al Campbell, Sally Baganall, and Robert Wells. See you next week.
Oh God, What Now? Was written and presented by Roz Taylor, with Seth Tevo, Matt Green, Rachel Cunliffe, and guest Bronwyn Maddox. The producer was Chris Jones, with audio production by Robin Lieber, video production by Kieran Leslie, and art by James Parrott. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, group editor Andrew Harrison, and Oh God, What Now? is a Podmasters production.